Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 28th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Christy Traina. Today's session number is TRC 2001-05, and it's titled, Rewriting Our Story, Is Heaven Up There? Let's listen in.
Hey people, let's begin. This is Ecotheology, and today we're talking about ecology, sin, and redemption, or is heaven up there? I'm Christy Traina, and I'm in the village for 2 weeks talking about ecotheology. I teach at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. Two things I should let you know officially. One of them is that if you are having trouble hearing me and asking me to speak louder is not working, there are assisted listening devices in the media center, which you're welcome to check out and bring. And if you want to run out and get one, please do so. The second thing is that this session, as you can tell, and all the other sessions are being taped, so that if you miss something that you would like to hear, you can either go and borrow the tape from the media center and listen to it at one of the listening stations around Holden, or you can buy the tape in the bookstore and take it home. I guess there were three things. The third one is that there are some books in the bookstore that are related to what I'm doing this week that you might be interested in looking at. First of all, there's a whole shelf on ecology and theology and spirituality. Some things that have been ordered especially for this week include The State of the World 2001, edited by Lester Brown, and it comes out every year. It's got great articles on what's happening to the water table, to our oil supply, to the atmosphere, those kinds of things. And if you read them cumulatively, you get a really good sense of what's happening. That's a wonderful resource to pick up, a very quick way to get acquainted with the state of ecology. The second thing that I ordered for this week is a book edited by Michael Shutt, who will actually be here in a few weeks teaching. Most of you have probably encountered books, How to Simplify Your Lifestyle and Be Happier, right? This is not that kind of book. This is a book about the relationship between our attitude toward consuming and our activity in consuming and its effect on the world ecologically and its effect on others in terms of justice. It's very thought-provoking, lots of wonderful snippets by terrific writers, and the other thing about it is that it has a guide in the back for using it as a discussion text. So it's something that if you want to plant a seed in your home congregations, if you want to get people talking about lifestyle and its effect on ecology, its effect on other people in terms of social justice, it's a wonderful, wonderful resource to take home and use. It's very accessible, not too guilt-inducing, more thought-provoking, and tends to elicit rather than beat people up. So it's a great book to know about. There's also a novel I asked for, which has nothing to do with either of these topics, but might interest those of you who've been to Steve Grantham's session on science and religion. It's called Lying Awake by Mark Salzman, and it's about the significance or the applicability of traditional spiritualities in the modern world, and it's also about the interface between body and spirit. As many of you may know, important mystics and famous writers have been many who have had some sort of epilepsy or brain problem, and this is about a nun who has a brain tumor and also has extraordinarily creative spiritual gifts in writing, and it's about all of these intersections. It's very sensitive, very easy, quick read, a wonderful kind of book to read in a place like this, and I recommend it. So those are resources you can make use of. Today, our question is a hard-hitting one. So I hope you've had your coffee, because this is a little bit heavier stuff than we've been doing part of the week. If theology is faith-seeking understanding, we're going to be doing a lot on the understanding end today. What I'd like to talk about today is what effect thinking ecologically might have on our thinking theologically. And I'm not being a very good teacher because I'm giving you all the notes at once, but that saves paper. So just try not to read too far ahead on me. so we can go through the beginning parts. The traditional story of Christian salvation, maybe we can map it a little bit. We've got some of the important events on the handout, right? So the traditional story of Christian salvation starts out with, where do we go at the beginning?
Creation,
right. And what's the state of the world at this point? It's good, right? It's way up here. All right, so the world and all things embodied and physical are good. They are unsullied. They're perfect. We're in paradise, right? In the Garden of Eden. Then what happens?
Sin.
The fall. Okay. And the traditional idea here is that humanity and the world go through a fall. Humanity is then sort of in conflict with the physical world, and we're sort of way down here. And then we go through sort of a life of peril and suffering down here. And then we have a covenant with Israel, and that improves things a little bit, right? Because at least then there's a place for us, and there are particular rules that if we follow, the land won't bite us back too much, right? So that's good. So God is continuing to tutor Israel in preparation for the incarnation, right? So here we have a little bump up because, after all, here's God in human flesh, right? So this raises the estimate of the world around us somewhat, although it really depends on what you emphasize. If you emphasize Christ's birth, you probably come up farther because that's really the thing. God becoming enfleshed in a human body, right? That's good. If you emphasize Christ's life, again, it probably comes up a bit because it talks about God's activity in the world and God transforming the world, God taking taking control, right, of matter and human community, and it would raise it even higher. Not so much, of course, if you emphasize Christ's death, and I'll explain that in a minute. Death still isn't too world-affirming, right? And neither is resurrection necessarily. Resurrection can mean something otherworldly. So you could end up with anywhere between here and there on Christ, but you do raise it a little bit, right? Then we got life coming out of here, wherever it happens to be, continuing in grace, and then in expectation of Christ's return and the end of the world as we know it, which would really be the eschaton, the end, the return, the fulfillment of all. So it takes really all this time to get the world back to where it used to be. Okay? This whole process is trying to push humanity and push creation back to where it was supposed to be originally before we screwed up. Okay? That's the whole process. That's what we probably learned in Sunday school and what we probably learned in seminary or graduate school, those of us who went there and studied theology. This is the Christian story. Christian story with these little variations in here, depending on what you want to emphasize about Christ. Okay. Now, there are some important implications about this. The first one being that humanity is the pinnacle of creation, because if you read the first version, for chapter 1 in Genesis, what you really have is, okay, God creates the day and the night, then God creates land and water, and God creates the plants, and God creates the animals, and then God creates humanity. Oh, good. This is the high point, right? This is the most important thing. Everything was pushing towards humanity. So the first thing about this account is that it puts human beings at the center. This is really what God values. This is what really God was pushing creation toward. And so we should take some lessons from this and be most interested or almost exclusively interested in human beings. Okay. And this next one has a typo, sorry. The other thing is that we lived in harmony with creation for only a very short time, of course, until eating the apple. And then after that, we were fighting it, right? The snake shall strike at your heel, you shall bring forth children in pain, this by the sweat of your brow you shall live, etc. And if you live in a really arid climate, that it makes a lot of sense, too. So by implication, then, the rest of creation's pretty unfriendly to human welfare. It's the wilds out there that need to be tamed. We talked about that a little bit the day that we did animal rights. So everything around us is either kind of a mechanism that we have to figure out how to ride and control and drive, or it's sort of a substrate. It's the stuff that we suck into ourselves in order to survive, or maybe it's both. Okay, so it's stuff. It's stuff we have to manage. Okay, it's not affected significantly by what we do, really. It's just the material we have to work with. In this case, what happens is that sin is really a rupture in relationship. We read the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden as a rupture in the relationship of obedience to God, right? And then we have the first thing that happens after that is Cain and Abel. Well, that's clearly, you know, human contention, right? And human contention and contention between human beings and God, that's sin, okay? That's really sin. Other things are not so much because we're just working with the stuff around us. The other thing is that we're not part of creation, really, then. You know, it's stuff, and we're important, it's unimportant. We just reside here until it's time for us to go to heaven. And I've talked about this a little bit this week, but there's a Neoplatonic point of view, which is very influential in Christian theology, not exclusively, but the idea is this, that we have God up here, and God is pure light and goodness, okay, and spirit. And God wants to create the earth. I'm not sure if we have any more. Have you got more handouts? Okay, thank you. God is going to create the earth and humanity and all of this stuff, but God is so pure, good, and spiritual that God really can't get his hands dirty. Why is God he? I'll explain in a minute, but God has to be he in this case. So God can't get his hands dirty. Alright? So God has to create all these other little gods. And they create other little gods who get kind of sullied in the process, so they're not quite so pure. They finally can create matter down here. So we have the world, which is this horrible, awful, dripping, decaying place with this little tiny spark in the middle, which is still, you know, what remains of God, okay? So, we are made of this awful, decaying stuff. The world is made of this awful, decaying stuff. And what we need to do is, this could be a picture of us or of the world, okay? We need to take this little spark and we need to escape back to God. We want to leave this behind, okay, and get back to God. So this is something that we reject, that we survive until it's time for us to return. Therefore, we're not really that interested in taking care of it, because even God doesn't think very highly of it, right? God didn't think highly enough of it to create it directly. Now, when we get to the Christian version, we take out these, right? Because we obviously can't believe in sub-gods. God does create directly, but still we haven't gotten rid of this idea entirely. Okay? So the idea is to escape from this awful stuff back to the pure light of God. Now, a companion idea to this, then, is that we don't only have a dualism between spirit and matter, but we have a dividing line And if we want to, we could put actually the left-hand side of this list on the top and the right-hand side on the bottom. We also have male and female and light, dark, all of these oppositions. We have rationality and emotion. Okay, all of these things. And all these pairs in opposition in the Eastern philosophy, they'd be put in kind of a yin-yang picture where they're equal and mutually dependent. In the Western point of view, they're mutually dependent, but one member of each pair is always much better than the other. So these things, spirit, male, light, rationality, and you can list a lot more, okay, are always better than stuff on this side, okay? This is what gets associated with the physical creation, and this is what gets associated with God. Yes?
Now, that diagram that you drew there, that isn't, now, it looks a lot like Gnosticism to me.
Yes.
Isn't that, I mean, didn't early Christianity utterly reject that scheme?
Early Christianity, in theory, rejected that scheme, but that doesn't mean you don't find it in Paul and John. And it doesn't mean you don't find it in early Christian authors that are still considered to be orthodox. You get some of this in Augustine, even though you get some of the opposite, too. And so there's still enough there in the orthodox Christian tradition for people to pull through. And being realistic now, suppose you lived in the Middle Ages. Suppose you lived in parts of Africa now. Suppose you have a body, actually, that is kind of a lemon. Some of us do, right? I have a friend who is afflicted with all kinds of bizarre things that nobody can figure out. And she doesn't do anything awful to herself to make herself sick, but she just has all these bizarre ailments, which are really there. And she feels pretty much this way about her body, right? If you didn't have access to contemporary medical care, if you didn't have access to food that would keep you from getting scurvy, etc., this would probably be a pretty friendly image for you. And you know, most of us aren't farming. Some of us would feel this way now about farming, probably, in some years. So, yes, Christianity utterly rejected this idea of the archons, the demigods, etc. But that doesn't mean that Christianity entirely got rid of the idea that matter was something inferior and that we kind of wanted to escape matter. Because, you know, Paul talks about the resurrection body. It's not at all clear that the resurrection body has any atoms or molecules in it. Right? So, there's still this piece of us, of our tradition, that feels this way, okay, and it's got some pretty good roots in traditional theology, even though nobody could really say the world was entirely bad. It's still inferior. It's good, but inferior, right? So, in this case, we're taught in Christian theology to believe that the center point of salvation history is what?
The resurrection. Death and resurrection?
Yeah, the resurrection or something having to do with Jesus, right? For some people, it's the incarnation. For some people, it's the crucifixion. It depends partly on what gospel you like, right? But the center point there is Jesus in some way, right? That's when things start to change, and it's the return of Jesus that gets us back toward where the world used to be. So the story of human life and creation is one of decline and then these various steady states, right? We don't get to move ourselves up. Jesus moves us up. God moves us up in the covenant, but we don't move ourselves up. Okay. The other idea here is that, see, there are some hand-ups here. We've got some still. Okay. Is that creation, there's nowhere for creation to go up here, right? Creation is complete at the beginning. It's full. We haven't obviously got the second coming of Christ yet, but creation in itself is complete and good here. There's nothing at all wrong with it. There's nothing at all deficient about it. Right? That's another piece of all of this. Okay. So we have the sense that this story is really the story of God's relationship with us, not so much about God's relationship with the world around us. And we also get the idea that salvation is salvation simply then from sinfulness, right? Not something to do with... And it gets us out of the world of matter, which is associated with sin. But salvation is not doing something wonderful to the world around us necessarily. We have some sense that the lion will lie down with the lamb, etc. But really, mostly salvation is about us. Mostly salvation is about us getting to heaven. And there might be this thing called the eschaton. The then existing lions and lambs lie down together, but we're not too worried about creation as a whole. Okay. One important thing about this, too, is that very early in Christian history, it was decided that death was the result of sin. Mortality would not occur, okay, except as punishment for sin. This is important because this is tying together what we would call natural evil, like illness and death and natural catastrophes, suffering that is not caused by injustice, okay, ties together natural evil with moral evil. Natural evil is kind of the consequence of moral evil, all right? So if we die, it's because we were bad, okay? Basically, if we get sick, it's because we were bad. Now, we know that ecologically, there are some good reasons for thinking this way. Yeah, if we treat the land badly, we will suffer, right? But it ties all physical suffering, all physical decay, all physical decline to death. I mean, to sin. Right? So the idea then that we die simply because we're sinful comes in very early in this period. Okay. Some gaps that get left here. What's the relationship between us and the rest of creation? You know, we use it is what the relationship is. We make use of it. Okay. Some other challenges that come up, are we able to use creation any way we want to, or has God put some rules there that we're supposed to follow? To what degree, you know, what exactly is our relationship to this stuff around us? And also, of course, how do we view other religious traditions? Because if this is the story, then what happens to people who don't adhere to this, right? And what happens to anyone who falls outside of the story? So some very, very interesting questions come up because in this point of view, anyway, our goal is release from the cycle of death. Our goal is release from the planet. Our goal is release from matter, from the rest of creation. Well, there's some people who are asking the question, if we think ecologically, how does that... Are there other stories that we can tell? And one of the key things about this, I think, is that there's always more than one story. When we're thinking poetically, what we need is a number of images to fill out the picture. One isn't enough. So the question is, can we add some images to this, some theological imagery to this, that will fill it out a little more and explain a little better how we fit into the rest of creation? Any other difficulties or questions for creation that this might raise for you? This particular kind of story. Yes?
Well, we have to keep in mind, you know, where the story came from, came out of, the culture and the time in which the stories were told. And I mean, it's very different from the time in which we live today and our concerns today.
Exactly. So. It is. It is. And that's one of the justifications for developing a new story,
yeah.
Right? Why do we have to limit ourselves to documents written in particular times and places? They explained creation and the relationship to the earth for those people in terms of their concerns and their experience. Until today, we were beginning to think we lived in a desert. But anyway, we don't live in that time and place. And if people were to begin with a blank slate and start writing creation stories, now they start in a very different way, right? So Brian Swimmy, Thomas Berry, Rosemary Radford, Ruther, a bunch of other people have said, okay, let's get out our pens and write a new one. Let's make sense now, okay? So I'll go through some of their progression very quickly just to give you a sense of what happens when we do this. One example, by the way, and one marvelous exercise might be to sit down and write your own, from your perspective, what happens in creation and salvation. What is the history of redemption in terms of the concerns that address us? Because some of you may actually find this one, if the first one is too anthropocentric, too centered on people, some of you may find this next one not quite centered enough on people, but let me put them together and get some. Sorry, I think I need to clean the eraser here. Here. People on the tape were trying to clear the dry erase board. Maybe you just need some old-fashioned caulk. There we go.
Probably need some old-fashioned soap and water.
Right. I think we have a special solution that you spray on. Okay. It's much better to read the universe story than for me to give you the short version here. But the first thing is that if you calculate out in Hebrew scriptures how long has the world been around, and people do this kind of thing who want to go very literalistically, right? You've got maybe 12,000 years there, okay, at the most. Well, Brian Swimming and Thomas Berry want to go back about 15 billion years. So right away, much bigger, right? And you'll see then that this makes a big difference for how you view humanity, because you've got 15 billion years of history. I'm not even going to try to fit it all on here, right? 5 billion years just to get the sun ready, okay? So you begin at the beginning with, you call it the Big Bang for poetic impact, they say the primordial flaring forth, okay? So you have the Big Bang here. And the universe then is an actor. The universe then is a subject, of a in a sense, a thing that unfolds, kind of like opening an umbrella or watching. I think one of the best examples would be to watch 4th of July fireworks. There's some really cool ones now that have a star, and then each arm becomes a star, and then each arm becomes a star, right? Kind of like that. So the universe becomes a subject, something that unfolds. It just fills up, okay? But it takes a long time. And the other thing is that this tiny little beginning that bursts open contains all the potential for future development. It's like a seed, all right? In comparison with the earlier story, when you have creation, it's all done, okay? Finished. It can only get worse, right? So then we have galaxies and we have supernovas. And in that sense, there's some violence in creativity, right? Some exploding, right? Some also destruction that happens. And then you have the sun, you have the earth beginning to develop as a living system. This is the prokaryote stage, and then we have the eukaryote stage, which is organisms that have membranes, that have nuclei, that have DNA, that have chromosomes, okay? Then we have all these things are coming out. We have plants and animals beginning to develop. That's 570 million years ago, okay? That's still a lot longer than 12,000, right? Okay, and in this description, this description of evolution is always not of organisms necessarily being in competition with each other, but organisms struggling to fit into their settings. Organisms that can fit into the whole system that's developing, you know, survive and develop. Those who don't quite fit end up dying off. So the question is, do you fit into the ecosystem? The ecosystem is developing as an interdependent whole, and organisms learn to fit into it, or develop in order to fit into it. Okay. Then we have 70 million years ago, primates. still a lot longer than 12,000, okay? About 200,000 years ago, we have Homo sapiens and the Neanderthal version. About 40,000 years ago, the modern human being, okay? Something like us. Okay, this is 40,000 over 15 billion. Anybody quick with math? I didn't calculate that out, but about, let's see, what percentage of time on Earth? If anybody wants to do a little math in the corner of their paper and tell me, so I can keep talking. Human beings have been around in their contemporary form, right? In the Genesis 1 story, humans have been around since day 7. Or in the Genesis 2 story, well, we're not quite sure how long the Earth was here before we were, but it probably wasn't 14,960,000 years. Or no, excuse me, 14 billion, yeah, something like that. So the proportion of time that we've been here is much shorter. We start looking a lot less important in the history of the universe when we do the math that way. And then we have maybe from 8,000 to 3,000 BCE, we finally have the Neolithic Age. We have what we would consider human beings who worship deities, who are creative artistically in a way that would be familiar to us, who have poetry and music and stuff like that, right? Humans that we would recognize, right? And then we have classical civilizations, which would go up to about 1500 of the CE. Okay, 1500. I don't know why they said, I guess through the Middle Ages, yes.
I just figured it out.
Okay.
Human beings have been around the percentages 1/375,000. 1/375,000 is the fraction.
Oh, okay.
You say.
So in terms of percent, that would be depressing. Something like.
So very small.
Yeah, yeah. Not very long, right? We haven't been here very long. So then we, very, very small proportion of time. Then we have the rise of nations, modern revelation. Then hopefully the Echozoic era and what they call celebration, which would be what we would think of as the eschaton or the renewed earth, right? Now, and we have also this idea of interdependence here. We are not resident aliens. We haven't been here very long, but we are part of this cycle of life that was set up long before we arrived and that we need to fit into and that we are continuous with instead of separate from. Okay? So here we have God as being the God of the universe, and we are this statistically insignificant portion of it, both physically, because who knows whether there is intelligent life anywhere else, right? And temporally, you know, 1/375,000th of the time that the universe has existed, right? So we have a couple of choices here theologically. We can either be really overwhelmed by the fact that God would be interested in us at all, or... And some theologians go this way. James Gustafson does this. My old professor, whom I love, but when he writes, he's almost depressing because he is so awed by God's grandeur and by God's attention to the rest of creation that he basically says, well, God must really not be all that interested in us after all. You know. So you can either get kind of depressed or very flattered. But in any case, you realize that God has a lot more going on than just us. I think it's kind of like being the first child in a family and believing that your parents are focusing all their energy and attention on you, and then your siblings come along And then you get a little older and you realize that your parents have jobs and they pay bills and they're worried about the health of their parents and you really are not the center of the universe, you know? It's this kind of feeling. Okay? In any case, this is not the friend we have in Jesus, you know, walking with me and talking with me in the garden. This is something very large and awesome. Then also, what about the fall here? The fall is something that takes place gradually. Instead of having something that goes like this, we have this gradual decline of, in a sense, which is associated with more and more exploited impacts on the earth. So actually, if we have Adam and Eve, they're up here. And this is us down here. Very different from the picture where we were starting, where Adam and Eve were here. We were starting to gradually come up. Okay? This reverses the whole story and says that the earliest humans were the most innocent and the most recent ones are the most noxious. Okay? So we experience cosmic unfolding continuing at the same time that we're experiencing moral and ecological decline. And that moral and ecological decline are all the more horrifying because they're seen against the background of the still expanding, still creative universe. Okay? So the harm that we're doing appears to be even greater than it would have otherwise. Well, it makes it hard to figure out where you would put Jesus on this then, because it turns out Jesus appears kind of in the middle of this process, and there's not a lot of evidence that he does anything to alter the course of things, right? In terms of our use of the earth. In fact, people like Lynn White and others would argue that he makes it worse, or at least that the way Christians have used Christian teaching has made it worse, because we've had this idea of the earth as not an important place for us to take care of, right? So we have this idea of co-creation, we have this idea of creation continuing, and we have this idea also of redemption encompassing the entire creation, because we are a tiny piece of this plan that is much larger than we are. And we also have this idea of interdependence and complexity. The other thing that we have is a very different view of death. In the earlier one, death is a punishment for sin. And in fact, eating of animals doesn't happen until after there's been a significant event around sin. God overreacting, you know, in the story of Noah and the ark, and say, oh, sorry, I don't think I'll do that again. You can eat the animals too. You know, sort of God giving a little bit back. But in this point of view, death is not an evil in the moral sense. It is something that, yes, it causes suffering, right? It's a sad thing, it's an end of a life, but it's not a result of moral evil, and it's not a moral evil in itself. I'm going to read a bit from Rosemary Radford Ruther's Gaia and God, which now is about 10 years old, but still worth reading, because I think she's one of the people who most carefully puts together the theological implications of an ecological outlook. Okay? She says, an ecological spirituality needs to be built on three premises: the transience of selves, the living interdependency of all things, and the value of the personal and communion. Many spiritual traditions have emphasized the need to let go of the ego, but in ways that diminish the value of the person. We need to let go of the ego in a different sense. We're called to affirm the integrity of our personal center of being in mutuality with the personal centers of all other beings across species, and at the same time accept the transience of these personal selves. And this sense of transience of ourselves allows us to feel greater kinship, she says, with other beings who are also transient. So it isn't sort of the end of ourselves, but the beginning of our connection with the rest of the universe. The material substances of our bodies live on in plants and animals, just as our own bodies are composed from minute to minute of substances that were once parts of other animals and plants, stretching back through time to prehistoric ferns and reptiles, to ancient biota that floated in the primal seas of the earth. Once my son recently said to me, something like, I wonder whether dinosaurs drank the water that I just drank. Right? He was thinking about this, because we were talking about water molecules and how when we flush the toilet, it gets cleaned up and goes back into the lake and all this stuff. It's kind of a neat thought. Our kinship with all Earth creatures is global, linking us to the whole living Gaia today. It also spans the ages, linking our material substance with all the beings that have gone before us on Earth and even to the dust of exploding stars. We need new psalms and meditations to make this kinship vivid in our communal and personal devotions. And she talks about how we can therefore become more compassionate and more connected to the world around us if we think of ourselves as being like the rest of the world in this way. Okay? So it's kind of a spiritual discipline that allows us to see things in a new light. She says the dialogue can become truncated. We can seek to grasp our ego centers of being in negation of others, proliferating our existence by diminishing that of others, and finally poisoning the wellspring of the life process itself. Or we can dance gracefully with our fellow beings, spinning out our creative work in such a way as to affirm theirs and ours as well. Then, like bread tossed on the water, we can be confident that our creative work will be nourishing to the community of life, even as we relinquish our small self back into the great self. Our final gesture as we surrender ourselves into the matrix of life can then become a prayer of ultimate trust. Mother, into your hands I commend my spirit. Use me as you will in your infinite creativity. So there's the sense of being useful to the earth in life, but also in death. And death then becomes a return to the organic interdependent universe where we can nourish it physically, right? So it's a very, very different understanding of where we're going in life. Now, it's not like there are no indications of this anywhere in Christian theology, and I don't want to give you the idea that Christian history has no support for this. One of the great whipping posts of Christian theology right now is St. Augustine. Oh, the terrible things that St. Augustine said about women, about children, about sin, about original sin. No. But then he also says this, which is quite surprising. See if it sounds like Ruther. There is for a time, this is, if you hang a person upside down, this is what he's talking about. He's talking about God's design and how it extends to everything. Hanging a person upside down will cause distress, then it will cause death, and then decay. But this does not undermine the natural order of physical processes that God has designed. This is sort of a morbid image, but it gives you the sense that Augustine is really in some ways on the same page as Ruther. There is for a time a kind of tumult in the corpse of exhalations disagreeable and offensive to our senses, for that is what we smell of putrefaction, which lasts until the body unites with the elements of the world. As little by little and particle by particle it vanishes into their peace. Nevertheless, nothing is in any way removed in this process from the control of the laws of the supreme creator and ruler who directs the peace of the whole scheme of things. For although minute animals are produced in the corpse of the larger animal, those little bodies, each and all of them by the same law of their creator, are subservient to their little souls. Their lives. And even if the flesh of dead animals is devoured by other animals, in whatever direction it is taken, with whatever substances it is united, into whatever substances it is converted and transformed, it still finds itself subject to the same laws, which are diffused through the whole of matter, for the preservation of every mortal species, establishing peace by a harmony of congruous elements. God designs things so that even when bodies decay, they support other bodies and continue the processes of the earth. And even Augustine, who was somewhat affected by that Neoplatonism we talked about, believed this, right? So he wasn't entirely negating of the world. So what would redemption or salvation look like from this point of view? What would we? What would it be? What would we being redeemed from?
That downward slide.
Yeah, the downward slide. What kind of? How would we define sin on the downward slope?
Anything that does harm to the earth and the inhabitants of the earth.
Right. Which is bigger than simply harms relationships with other human beings or somehow offends the rules that God has given us that may be seen as kind of disembodied from the world, right? So it's anything that affects negatively this interdependent community we live in, right? Because then we're offending against the whole system of God. And we're messing up God's pet project, you know. I mean, we've all done that to a sibling, a friend, or a parent once, probably. Really messed up some neat thing they were working on. Wow, that's devastating. So we're messing that up. So how would we be redeemed? What would redemption look like for salvation from this point of view?
Like enlightenment or something.
Uh-huh.
Where the people rise above what the destruction.
Right. So first of all, you have to understand it.
Yeah.
Right. First of all, you have to understand how things work.
But the thing is, people live so removed from nature that's a big problem with redeeming ourselves unless you really have a love of nature, and we don't want to destroy it. But being so removed the way we live, people don't have that love.
Right.
Unless they get out in nature themselves.
Or at least to land, which isn't covered by asphalt. Right. My husband works in a church in Chicago, and there are kids in that church that don't ever leave the city, ever. And sometimes people behave as though it's frivolous of him to want to get them out to a state park or out of the city. You know, there are so many great things to do in the city, so many cultural things to do in the city that the kids also don't have access to. Why aren't you doing those things? Well, they do some of those. But Bill says, they need to understand that there are cows and that there's corn and that that we're supported out there by this land. There's a refrain for the week in this class anyway has been that there's no such thing as a post-agricultural society, right? We will always depend on the land, always. And if you don't see that dependence, the kids who don't know what a carrot plant looks like or whether cherries grow down low near the ground like strawberries or up high like blueberries, right? They don't. It's very hard to imagine if you don't see it. Yes?
But then to complicate that picture is, I was just talking to Paul Olson, and he was saying that, do you know what the most polluted state in the country is? Iowa. Agriculture.
Right. Right. So simply seeing the land is not enough to get you to take care of it, right? Because farmers are caught up in, an economic system that does not help them, encourage them to behave in a way that cares for the land, right? Encourages them to do the opposite, actually, right? To try to put on the next pesticide and the next fertilizer and the next whatever to increase their yield per acre a tiny amount.
And they're not working with nature or with creation. They're really working against it.
Right.
And trying to kind of manipulate it or use it for more selfish purposes and not really taking into account the damage that it's doing.
Although I would argue it's right now for a lot of farmers it's for survival purposes.
But still,
they're
paid so.
Mm-hmm.
Selfish.
Well, there's some that do the no killing, so that's a little bit.
Yeah.
It's a huge, complicated mess, our agricultural system right now. It's a monster.
Yes.
Could you look upon then that definition of sin, those that try to amass into smaller groups of power to control other people in the land?
Yes. that's one important thing. And, you know, that's wonderful because it ties together the justice consideration, human social justice consideration, and the ecological consideration. I think it's one really great indication of what you've said and what you've just said about these constraints on farmers, right? That we can't separate the issues of human relationship in community and human relationship to the land. They go hand in hand, right? Because farmers have a hard time behaving in an ecologically responsible way because they're working in an economic and political system which makes their profit margins tiny or sometimes non-existent. What they're trying to do is not lose any more money, actually, much of the time, right? So these two things are interdependent. It's not just what we do to the land directly, but the systems that we create that make it hard for other people to take care of the land.
Right. And my behavior as a consumer and what I eat directly affects what they're having to do on their land, where I get my food.
Right. Going back, so those of you who are here for Tuesday night's forum, talking about whether anything runs the world other than money. That's another debate, but anyway. If we live in this money system, maybe one thing we can help us use our money to encourage people to behave responsibly. Unfortunately, not all of us can afford to do that. Again, those of us who come to Holden have some advantages. Where we live, there are people who can't travel to a grocery store with organic produce. And if they got to that grocery store, the organic produce would cost probably between 20 and 50% more and they wouldn't be able to buy it. Right? So, it's tough. We can't do it all by consumer choice. But we can have some effect. And if you look around where you are living, you will see, I hope, because this is true near us, there are some more organic farms. You know, there are more than there used to be. But it's still very small, and it's still very difficult for people to go in this direction. So, one of the implications of this, interestingly, in this picture, we're tiny. We're so small. We're so insignificant. And yet, in this picture, we are also more significant than in the other story. Because creation is not finished. It never was finished. It's still moving toward completion. So we have the power and the responsibility to be co-creators with God, to make sure that it gets to the point where God intends it to go. So one of the ingredients of redemption, not the only one, is that we can turn this around. We can turn it around to some degree. For those of you who are interested in things theological, this is a side note. For those of you who aren't, you can ignore me for a minute or two. There is a strain in theology which began in the 60s, really the 70s, that came off of some of the philosophy of Alfred North Whitehead, called process theology. And the basic idea here is that each moment and entity in creation sort of prehends or includes all that came before it. So, you know, here am I, and I include all of the history of my family and everything that I've eaten and everything that I've done. And as I move on to a new place, new influences come into me, but I take along with me all that I had in the past. And so there's this sense that whatever change has happened in creation, we may have pushed the ecosystem down like this, and whatever we do to begin to bring it up, we'll have to carry all this baggage with it, certainly. We can't put the petroleum back in the ground, right? But we can bring in other spiritual and material influences and begin to turn ourselves around spiritually and physically. Okay. So we have all these new influences coming in, and we can have an effect on creation. We are, the good thing about being created in the image of God is that we are co-creators. We can move, we can see things and then move them. And this is one of the advantages, or one of the bright sides, I should say, in this theology. There is, I've been doing entirely too much talking. I'm sorry. One thing to think about with this one. It's very, very tricky figuring out what to do with the individual spiritual journey in this picture. Because each of us go through the process of maturing spiritually and sinning and needing to be redeemed and becoming wise and all of that. And so all of that has to get figured into this curve also. Okay, it's not a smooth curve up, but it's a very different understanding of creation. And I hope to just leave you with this alternative picture and invite you to develop other pictures like this to figure out how do we put together a more comprehensive and fulfilling understanding of our connection with creation and God's intention in creation. One neat thing to do would be to kind of write a story yourself that goes with this. So thank you for spending this Saturday morning on something so heavy and serious. I should say that for those of you who haven't come to any of these sessions, I have a reading list somewhere here of books that you might like to look at. Some of them I've mentioned and some of them not. But there's some starting points to read on religion and ecology. And so I'll put those out and invite you to pick one up. And go out and enjoy the sun. Yeah. Thank you. You off today? Angela. Oh, yes. Really? Well, I really hope the sun stays around.
I want it.
Well, yeah. Right back.